Good afternoon, everyone. Nothing like teaching a class. They don't know
anything. You want me to go?
I'll do it. I was just commenting, this is just like teaching a class to get everybody to order. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Morty Yalofsky, and I'm one of the co-chairs of the Campus Community Committee. And with me is Robin Wiltshire, who's another of the chairs. Ivan Nielsen and Peter Knox are also co-chairs within the program. And it's my pleasure really to invite everyone to the first of our lunch hour programs being organized by the Campus Community Committee. Today's topic, which we're going to have, is going to be basically the global economic crisis, and we're really pleased that we were able to get Reuben Brenner, who's a colleague of mine in the Desos Hotel Faculty of Management, who's also a good friend, who will go ahead and be answering questions that will have been raised. Reuben certainly needs no introduction because he is an expert in this particular area. Reuben holds the REPAP Chair in Economics in the Desos Hotel Faculty of Management. He's been a Fulbright Fellow. He's been a Killam Fellow as well, and he's a member of the Royal Society. Another colleague of ours is also a member of the Royal Society. So we're really pleased to have him. Reuben is quite prolific. He has published 8 books, the last one being A World of Chance, Betting on Religion, Games, Wall Street. So it's quite appropriate, and that book only came out in 2008, so we'll see, is it right, is it wrong, etc. It's a year old, in a sense, just as the economic situation started. In addition to his publications, Reuben has had articles that have been published in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes magazine, the National Post, Financial Times, and I can go on and on, but certainly he's prolific and he's very well respected for his opinions with respect to economic policy. The way in which we were going to organize this is as follows. We've selected this room because by being here, we have the ability to basically webcast this throughout the university, so we know there are people who can look at it at the web, as well as McDonald campus is connected with us right now live. We've asked people who wish to go ahead and submit questions, and we'll start off with some of those questions, and if we do have time, we certainly can go ahead and open it up to the audience. I apologize in advance that I'm going to have to leave at 5:12 because I've got to teach a very large section of about 175 kids at 1 o'clock, so I will be sneaking out. But when you go ahead and raise the questions, please no lengthy introductions in terms of who you are or on and on and on. Please ask the question directly, and please do not say, in your opinion. You'll get to know Reuben. Reuben has his own opinion. He'll give you his opinion whether you like it or not. Okay? So this will be Reuben. So let me start off really with a question that I basically have gone ahead and raised.
Can I just say, sure. When someone raises a question, if they can just wait for the mic to come to you.
Right.
We have some roving microphones.
The first we're going to ask you, for the first part, we're actually going to look at several questions that have already been submitted. And one of the questions which I have gone ahead and raised is that if you look effectively at the market from June of 2008, which was a high point, up until, we'll say, March 10th, plus or minus 2009, the S&P went down 53%. If you look at what happened, that's over a 9-month period. If you look at what happened from March 2009 up until September 11th of 2009, the S&P rose 53%. If you go ahead and look at the TSX as well, it went down 50% and went up 50%. Now, for those of you who know economics, you know we're down 25%, regardless of the fact, because when you go up, you don't go up as much as once you go down. So the question that I'm concerned with is about sort of the rapid gain of the equity markets. Have they moved up too far, and have they moved up too quickly? And one of the things, and I just pointed out to Reuben, those of you who get Business Week, I received mine, and if you open Business Week or you look at the cover, the first question is why the market will keep going up, if you look at it this way. But if you accidentally turn it upside down, you get to see basically why the market is going nowhere. They didn't say it's going down, but the question is why the market is going nowhere. So, Reuben?
Okay. Well, thank you. The magazine or newspapers are a good example. Those of you who remember Hans Christian Andersen, when I read to my kids, and there is the story of the Snow Queen, I think, and the first paragraph is that in the land of I don't know what lived a very clever queen. She read every newspaper every morning, and she forgot them immediately. So clever was she. So don't believe, I mean, the Business Week, Fortune, other magazines had Enron or everybody else on the cover praising them. You have to use your own judgment, something that I shall come back later. I'm not giving, as I told to the organizers, I'm not giving a speech, but the questions that you have sent me, I shall try to answer through them. And I think you will understand where, how do I see the basic problems, why some of them have been solved, why some of them, many of them have not been solved, and that will answer indirectly Morty's question about the stock market. So let me just read what the first question that he sent. Since mid-June 2008 to March 2009, about 9 months, the S&P fell about 53%, and from March 2009 until September 11, it went up 53%. So just an easy calculation, if you have $10, goes down by 50%, you have $5, goes up by 50%, you get up to $7.50, so you lost 25%. And Morty's question is it too quickly, or where are we heading? Well, I would say that some of the fundamental problems that led to this crisis have not been dealt with and have not been solved, and it's unclear how and when they will be solved. So let me start with the larger one. You have a fundamental imbalance in the world going on for a while, where U.S. consumers are spending like crazy. The rest of the world is subsidizing them, essentially by buying up, both exporting to the U.S. from China and from other parts of the world. The proceeds they are investing in treasuries, which are giving you almost 0% or no return, keeping the interest rates low in the States. Now, how can this go on? Or why does it even happen? Why would China with, say, $2 trillion in reserves, why should it put those hardened savings of their own people, invest in U.S. treasuries at zero, in depreciating dollars, and then everybody is blaming the U.S. consumers that they are spending on houses and vacations and so forth. And people say, well, this has something to do with capitalism and things like that. Well, first of all, it has nothing to do with any such generalizations. First of all, China is not a capitalist country, right? So it's to blame it on something like that, it's ridiculous. China simply decided on this strategy of encouraging exports and keeping their currency relatively low and linked to the U.S. dollar, because it, at least that's the official line, I don't believe it, is sustaining employment within China as if there was no other way of creating employment but by exporting it to the U.S. or the rest of the world. Well, if you think about it, you may ask yourself the following. I mean, China is still a dirt poor country. How come you cannot open that country more, allow people to become more entrepreneurial, start a lot of businesses locally, instead sending the money to the U.S. to buy houses? It doesn't have much sense, but if you consider that the biggest threat to any dictatorial government, and in China you have only the Communist Party, is if you open more widely the capital markets. Because if you open them, then you are dispersing power, and then you lose if you are the only party. So whatever the angle under which they rationalize this policy, I would say it's a disguise to a self-interest of a dictatorial party to stay longer in power. Now this imbalance, so the question is, okay, China is doing that. What can the U.S. do? Well, the U.S. could have done things, but it didn't. And this is one of those fundamental things that has not been resolved, because they more or less linked their currency to the U.S. dollar. So if you have these capital flows, China exporting to the U.S., getting back the money flowing back immediately to the U.S. and investing in treasury and keeping the interest rates low, that leads to a credit expansion unless the Federal Reserve is managing better the dollar, which it didn't. Since end of 2002, actually, this would have been one of the ways to mitigate the credit expansion, would have been for Greenspan not to have the easy monetary policy, not to let the dollar fall and with it the Chinese currency, and you wouldn't have this huge expansion of credit. Now, why the U.S. didn't do it and did not sustain the value of the dollar, and there are big discussions now about how it will continue to be a reserve currency and for how long, that I don't know if that's the forum to get into that. But as you can see, if you just even casually open the newspapers, it's one of the big issues that is being discussed now, whether or not the U.S. dollar will continue to be a reserve currency. Now, this is, I would say, the United States luck, and this is what it gives time internally to buy some time and reorganize, that it's not so much that you have to do everything right or even just many things right. If many other countries do stupider things than you can do well. And luckily for the United States, there is absolutely no other currency for the moment that can replace it in the world. It is true that you hear noises that China would like to go into gold and would like to do other things, but those things are relatively minuscule. For the moment, the U.S. dollar is still the reserve currency. Europe doesn't want to take its role, and anyway, the euro is if you think about it, it's a very kind of unusual money, unprecedented historically. Yeah, it looks the same type of paper, but actually you have here a kind of money that it's the first time that is not backed by a government, and it is not anchored in gold, so which was the case until, let's say, Bretton Woods or earlier even more. This gives the U.S. some time to perhaps reorganize its things, and there are solutions to that. However, for the moment, it has not been done. So going back to your question, is there a big risk in exchange rate fluctuations, which you can see just looking at the Canadian U.S. dollars or others, they have been fluctuating one relative to another by 50% or more up and down. Going back to the statistics about how much the S&P went up, yes, the S&P went up by, say, 40 or 50%, but at the same time, the dollar went down relatively to a lot of currencies. So even that is a little bit illusionary. So that's, I would say, one mistake that was not corrected. It is true that now the G20 promised to have some coordination between countries and have a kind of managed decline, but once again, if you look back historically, many times countries tried to do that, going back to the Plaza, maybe some of you remember Black Monday from 87, that was not successful. You go back earlier, when Bretton Woods was dismantled, that took quite a while, and meanwhile there were huge fluctuations in exchange rates and stock markets. So that's one fundamental mistake that wasn't corrected. The second big one that hasn't yet been corrected, there are promises, and they are working on it, and somehow they try to manage it, is the role of the Federal Reserve. Those of you who thought about how today the role of the Federal Reserve is defined as a lender of last resort. Now, for many years, people took it for granted that this meant that the Federal Reserve serves as a lender for last resort for commercial banks. And it had to because, yeah, you have the deposit insurance and so forth, fractional banking. I shall not get too technical into that. But what happened in the last crisis? Suddenly, almost everybody became a bank, which cannot be. I mean, suddenly GMAC became a bank, investment banks became banks, EIG was rescued as if it was a bank, other financial institutions. Well, that's an unprecedented situation. So the rules of previously we thought we know what is a bank and what is a lender of last resort. Today, we just don't know. It is true that now they are saying, well, sorry, one more thing, money market funds, although many people lived under the illusion that they are like banks because they performed as banks and they saw that the deposits there and bank and the accounts that they had are similarly insured like in commercial banks. In fact, that was not true. That's why they paid higher interest rates. But in the panic, they were rescued too, although the Federal Reserve says that it will not rescue them in the future. But who knows? For the moment, they rescued them also. So all these rules that we had in the past are now up in the air, and what the government or the Federal Reserve should define are what will happen, what is really a bank, what are we insuring, what we are not insuring, when will the Federal Reserve buy up assets from these financial institutions. All these rules are not clear. The third thing that is not clear is, in the past, if you looked, if you didn't succeed, often, more often than not, the company could go bankrupt. Now, suddenly, also, that rule was thrown out, and GM or others suddenly were rescued. Not only were rescued, but also the U.S. government violated principles. You had very regular bankruptcy proceedings that you had to go through if you are a bankrupt company. Now, also those were overruled. So these are, I would say, pillars of a commercial society that now they are all in a flux. So can you, when the rules of the game are not clear, how do you play? So that's why I'm not saying that, you know, the stock market cannot go up and down, but until these rules are clarified, I would say it's much more speculation than anything else. You are really betting here not so much on the companies, but what politicians will do, whether in Washington or in other countries, how they will coordinate their actions. And once you say politics, then the whole analysis of markets has very little to do with what you did in the past, and you have to be placed in Washington and lift your finger or lobby or do a lot of other stuff to have an idea where the winds are blowing. Let me... I'll come back. I know that in the popular press, everybody is saying, well, this whole crisis was linked to what happened in the housing market and then with what happened in the financial market with securitization. Well, you always need, if you look at the housing market, it is not exactly accurate to say that this happened just because suddenly you had mortgage brokers appearing in California and convincing somebody who lived in a hut that you can now live for the next 3 years in a mansion and not pay anything, which actually did happen. But you have to do a step behind and see how did that come about. Well, actually, once again, it goes back to Washington, because you had there a couple of institutions, which by now are bankrupt, Fannie and Freddie Mae, and the Department of Housing, which over the last more than a decade, the HUD had the policy that Fannie and Freddie must give at least, as I remember, by 2005, they had to give something like 52% of the loans to mortgages that were given to people whose median income was, if I recall, 40% less, whose income was 40 or 60% less than median in that area. Briefly, what I would call junk consumers. So I don't know why, and these were later called, if you read the press, ninja loans. No income, no job, no asset. Yet you could get these loans to move into houses. So to say that this somehow happened because somehow the markets that didn't work, well, that's not correct. It was pushed from Washington. Otherwise, the banks would have never given this type of loans. Now, obviously, now we hear a lot about, you know, poor people losing their houses and so forth. Well, you know, words are cheap, and I am sure that there are quite a few innocent people who didn't know what they were signing on. My hunch is that the vast majority knew. If you are in a trailer park and you don't have a job and you don't expect to have a job, you don't have any skills, and somebody is telling you now you can live in a new three-bedroom apartment and not pay anything or pay less than your rent on your trailer, well, as stupid as you are not that stupid. I mean, and if you are, then you live for 3 years in a mansion, be happy, and now move out. I mean, what can you do? If some of you, let's say, were offered the Buckingham Palace for 3 years, and if somebody is ready to, you know, wouldn't you accept it? Why not? Why not live in Buckingham Palace for 3 years, and then you move out? Well, after getting adjusted to a style, maybe that's a problem, but that's it. Now, how were these? So these bad decisions coming originally from Washington, how did they bubble up into a huge financial problem through the banks? Well, here the story is a little bit more complicated, because if you, at least even today, if you go to any Canadian bank, and during all these years, if you want to take out a mortgage, the bank is doing proper due diligence. They ask what is your income, the employer's letter, to know how reliable that is. Even then, you have to put down 20% roughly of the value of the house. They will do all that due diligence regularly on your mortgage, because the bank is holding that mortgage. So the bank doesn't want to get into the housing business for you to not pay and then try to auction your house. They want the regular payments. The moment you have a financial innovation, which at first sight looks reasonable, because what people said is, well, why would the bank sit on these local mortgages? Why not diversify across the country? Sometimes Texas is doing well because of oil. Sometimes the state of New York is doing well because the financial sector or the media is doing well. Sometimes the tech does well. Why not pull all these mortgages together and securitize them? Historically, the default rate on mortgages in the States was around 3%. I think even less, 2-point-something. So you can make a kind of reasonable calculation that if you pool all these mortgages together and then you split them up somehow, some people will be ready to bet on the trenches where all the 3% bankruptcy will be concentrated, and those will pay higher interest rates. And those above them will be more secure because they are backed by the better consumers. So those can get AAA ratings. And then those will be held by people who want more security. So a priori, this made sense. The problem was not just in the execution, but what such an innovation implies. Because if previously the banks were holding the mortgages, and so they had to do the due diligence, the moment they became just a distributor of mortgages, they no longer had the incentive to to do the due diligence. They just said, oh, here we are the mortgages. Then there were the intermediaries who just sold it to investment banks. The investment banks slashed and put them together, went to the rating agencies to get the rating for that, and then they sold them. So you have three big changes here. One is that the bank is no longer the holder of these mortgages, but is just the distributor. What that means that if previously I had to be really a banker to try to, and what does a banker mean? He has to do due diligence. He has to assess the chances of you paying regularly the payments, the employment, how reliable, how trustful you are, and so forth. The moment you are just distributing, then the bank becomes really just a kind of marketing company. You are no longer doing the due diligence. The due diligence now, because of this financial innovation, should have been done by another institution, namely the rating agencies. Now, the problem was that the rating agencies either didn't understand, let me give the benefit of doubt, having worked with them and tried to convince them that they were wrong, they didn't think so, but whether that was honest or they were too much paid for all this, I let others speculate. The fact is, they made, so to give the benefit of doubt, they made the mistake that with the financial innovation, you can continue to assume that the default rate will stay at the historical 2.5-3% level. Now, is this a honest mistake? Well, you in academia, I mean, make this type of mistakes also, looking just at historical data and not seeing how an innovation changes people's behavior. Although over time, this became clearer and clearer that the default rate will increase exactly because the incentives were so changed that suddenly all these loans became so easily available. Still, people assumed that the rating agencies are making the adjustments, and since they were very complex, so nobody quite understood how they were priced. They were running all type of models on it. Still, people saw that those institutions did their homework. They didn't. So people, whether both in the States, in Canada, in the rest of the world, continued to buy these securities that the rating agencies rated as AAA and AA or whatever, assuming that somebody was still doing due diligence, although due diligence of a kind of different way, more on a kind of aggregated level. So you had here, now the reason I say it is not so simple is because somehow, because the bank's roles changed and became distributors, and those who percolated to the top of the bank's management were more marketers. I met a couple of them, and I don't think that they were bankers, really. I don't think that they understood what was happening. Now, can you blame them for that? I'm not sure, because, yes, the banks became marketers of this type of mortgages. The rating agencies, there is much more problem with that, but the rating agencies had their role. Again, it's a government mandate because it's all the three of them, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch, have a kind of government monopoly because insurance companies and other financial institutions can hold certain assets only if these rating agencies give them AAA. Is this fundamental mistake corrected now? Well, people pay much more attention to the rating agencies and what they are doing. But I wouldn't be confident that their rating matters. Again, we go back. It's unavoidable that somebody must do the due diligence. So I would say if we go back to Morty left his question about where the stock market is heading, Well, if you don't have this fundamental, what I would call pillars of commercial society dealt with, and the rules are so up in the air, I don't think you can make very good predictions about markets. So that was just answer to the first question. Let me go to the second, because that will continue the story. Because I think it's better, like me lecturing in the abstract, you can see the relation between the questions and the picture and whether there are remedies. Some have argued that individual greed has been a major contributor in creating the current financial crisis. They claim that individuals in the banking and the financial institutional community put the financial system at risk for personal short-term gains. Would you agree with the claim? If not, who would you believe is responsible for the current financial collapse? In your opinion, is the financial system flawed? Well, the last two questions I more or less answered. Now about greed. Look, human nature didn't change the last 10 years. It's exactly the same one. So to say that greed caused this and greed caused that, I would call it journalistic claptrap. The issue is people have all the time been greedy. Who isn't greedy? I mean, we all are greedy for some things. The question is, are we held accountable for our actions or not? So what failed here is not, you know, that's human nature. Nobody succeeded to change them, you know. You have always moralists who try, but it never happened. It's the matter of having the proper checks and balances in place. Whether once it was the bank who were doing the due diligence, that had people in check. I don't think that poorer people before were less greedy if they didn't want to live in bigger mansions, but nobody gave them the mortgages to go into a bigger mansion. The rating agencies should have taken that role, but didn't. So it's really a failure of accountability. It is true that once that happens, that yes, then you will go for whatever compensation you can get. And here it is, yes, then it is a failure of the bank management not to see what is going on and paying out a lot of money for what later turned out to be not beneficial at all. So there is a lot of, I would say, people call it justice. I don't think that there is a big difference between justice and revenge, you know, it's just a nicer word. But it's not just a nicer word, but it's backward looking. Yes, maybe it gives you some satisfactory kind of sentiments if somebody is punished because having been lived well from all these mistakes that governments and others did. For me, the question is much more, the more important question is to do the things now, right, so that these things won't happen. And that is to restore accountability at all types of levels. So I would say, you know, justice for me, it's relatively easy and backward-looking. The tough thing is to solve the problem and when you're moving forward. There is a lot of discussion about compensations, that somehow capping them would solve the problem. I don't see that. The question isn't, you know, how much you are compensated, but whether or not, what are you compensated for? I don't hear anybody capping, you know, Gates, who made $40 billion is his personal wealth from Microsoft. Nobody, do you want to cap that? I don't hear discussion about that. Warren Buffett has another $40 billion from his knack of allocating capital. Nobody is talking about he's capping it voluntarily because he announced that he is giving away his money when he dies to charity and leaving just peanuts to his kids. But that's his own choice. Nobody has capped that. We can see actually in this province what happens when we try to cap this or that in the health business, then the doctors are moving away. And probably the same thing would happen in the financial market. You will try to cap somebody in the banks, then they will go to hedge funds or go to the Bahamas or to Cayman Islands and do it somewhere else, if you have that kind of skill of allocating capital. So I don't think that this kind of, this is more, you know, political kind of thing. All right. Next. There are those, and this will be linked to the... There are those who advise us that the best investment strategy today is to purchase gold. Do you believe that there is value in buying gold today? Well, there are two ways of looking at gold, and that's why you see the disagreement in the press. When the world was more or less on a gold standard, that's one type of way of managing the currency and imposing some discipline on the various governments. In those situations, since gold is actually fixed, nobody was talking about gold as an investment. It was just the paper currency was anchored in it, and that's it. Now, the moment you don't trust the government and you don't trust the printing presses of the Federal Reserve, then the question is, well, what would you buy? Well, if you remember the 1970s when Nixon abandoned formally the gold standard and you had the 15% or 18% inflation in U.S., in the U.S. and Canada, yes, the price of gold jumped up because people saw that, well, if the U.S., you cannot rely on all these Western countries for their managing their monetary affairs, what are you left with? You will not buy the Russian ruble then, which was a communist country. Anyway, you couldn't. So, yes, gold was then a good investment. Today, maybe it's not happening to the same extent, but yes, there is a lot of distrust exactly how these monetary affairs will be solved. And until there is another reserve currency, I would say people are flocking a little bit into gold as an insurance against all this untrustful government. So gold is really, I would say, if you don't trust, then you go there. Here, if you ask what is the substitute for gold, well, actually I believe that the Australian dollar or the Canadian dollar are pretty good substitutes, in part because these are two countries that anyway have plenty of resources, gold included, so that can work. Would is it better than gold or that I don't want to give here financial advice. Okay. Now, next question, sorry. Yes. What has this recession meant for Keynesian economics? Okay. Is Keynesian economics experiencing a real rebirth, as economists like Paul Krugman claim it is? Well, I think that Paul Krugman, neither now nor before, he doesn't know what he's talking about. It's if you buy the first part of the story that I told you, it has nothing to do with Keynes. I think actually this is the problem. This is part of the problem today, when economists or others live with the vocabulary and the languages of some theories that were invented 50 or sometimes 100 years ago, and they are being used because they have no idea in their head how to look at the present situation, so they look in the past for comfort. I mean, it happens all the time. If you look back in, I don't know, not exactly prehistory, but if there is anybody in anthropology here, you always had all the society struggled. How do you justify decisions of an authority to do something? Based on what? So in primitive tribes, they threw the bones or the dice or whatever, and they said that the divine controls the throw of the dice. And whatever the throw showed, that's what you did, it was rationalized. Later, people thought, no, that's too primitive, we shall go to the oracles or the prophets. So their word was considered to be the word of God, so whatever they said, this rationalized the actions of the government. You go later, you had astrology. I mean, today maybe some people are laughing at it, but for almost 200 years, astrology was considered to be science. And the monarchs had their councils of astrological advisors. Pretty much they have today councils of economic advisors. No difference. And they listened to it, and if you go and visit some castles in Europe, you will see that in the bedroom of the monarchs, there is above the bed a kind of notebook almost, that to write down immediately his dreams and so forth. And in the morning, the astrologer was supposed to interpret, to go to war, not to go to war, to spend on this bridge, not to spend on this bridge, and so forth. So they always you always needed a kind of rationalization. Now, to be fair to Keynes, he wrote his book in the 1930s, and if you bother to read it, it's an extremely obscure book, and it has nothing to do with anything that is happening today. Actually, if you just read the few pages, first few pages, he says, well, I deal only with a closed economy, and the problem that I struggle with is the following, that suddenly businessmen are becoming, out of the blue, pessimistic. He calls that animal spirits, as if, you know, this kind of randomness happens out of the blue. So to compensate for this pessimism that strikes them, now hold your breath, it's politicians and bureaucrats who can replace and be more optimistic in situations such as this, and therefore spend more, and this is how the country is restored to a happy future. Now, I a little bit, you know, caricaturized it, but it's not far from what you find in the book. But there was some, there is always some truth behind bad models. What happened in England at that time is that during the 1920s, when actually Churchill was at the Treasury, they made the big mistake after the First World War. There was a big debate in England at what level to restore the English pound. And some people testified it went on for a year, that it shouldn't be restored to the level that it was before the Second World War, but it should be linked in where it is now, where it devalued relatively to gold. Gold standard was abandoned temporarily during the First World War. For whatever reason, again, I shall not get into that, Churchill decided, no, we are restoring it to the level of pre-World War I. Now, that was a huge mistake, because that implied that the wages and the prices of everything in England became extremely expensive. So you suddenly had a huge unemployment in England. Prices, in fact, had to drop to fit this level. So in this kind of unusual, it's almost, yes, the government and the central bank in England, they did a big mistake. So the policies that Keynes recommended were, in a way, correcting the mistake that the government did. And that's the best thing that the government can do. The problem is, when do you recognize the previous mistake? Now, the interesting part about, just to a few more notes about Keynes, that he, for years, people debated that, and he was not a kind of academic, he was really involved in public life. This is where he spent most of his time. And people criticized, they don't understand the book, and so forth. And he promised, you can read two volumes edited by somebody called Moggridge, all the correspondence, letters, presentations, that he will correct, that yes, he is wrong, this is not right, that is not right. Then Second World War came, he was involved in that, and in 1940, and he stopped writing. And then in 1945, after the war, he wrote one essay called How to Pay for the War. in which you will not find any Keynesian analysis. Actually, he does a purely what you would call today a monetarist analysis. Then he got a heart attack and he died. So whatever you call Keynesian today, it's, I would say, yes, it is somehow drawing on that book, but it's really what academics developed after. And my hunch is that it was successful in academia and penetrating the political language, because independent of what are the institutions of the country, that type of model promises you that just by manipulating this and that, you can maintain growth and so forth. So it doesn't matter if you are a dictatorship, doesn't matter any institution, there is no mention of that. You solve some two equations with two unknowns, or four equations with four unknowns, and that's it. That's the solution for every country. Now, if you think about it, that's a very comfortable thing for many to hear, that you have a kind of theory that justifies the role of government no matter what that government is. So, no, I would say Krugman is completely wrong in this. That has what is happening today has absolutely nothing to do with Keynesian model, unless you say the following. But that's not what Keynes says, so that's a kind of interpretation why what somebody would call a Keynesian policy would work. If you think about any country at any time, you really have just four sources of capital. Well, you have people's savings, you have capital markets. If you don't have capital markets and savings, or inadvertently you destroy them, as inflation sometimes do, as mistakes of various policy mistakes have done now, then how can you finance the future? The only institution that remains is the government or crime, but let's put that aside. You know, in some countries they overlap, but let's not talk about them. So if you say that, yes, what happened in the last 2 years was that because of this series of mistakes, that one fed on each one, and people didn't really perceive the interactions between them, capital markets suddenly froze, and that's why you needed a government intervention at that point, that's right. But that has nothing to do with Keynes. Okay? So the policy may look like, to somebody, you know, it's like the old saying, if you have a hammer and then everything, and you want very badly to use it, everything will look like a clue, then, well, then, you know, you will use it. But no, it has nothing to do. All right, next question. How much time we have? Okay. We have all seen the advertisements telling us with proper financial planning, Freedom 55 was within reach. Forget about that. Was the notion of Freedom 55 just a dream for the average person, and is Freedom 85 a more realistic? Well, I see that those who wrote this question is an optimist. He expects to live to 85. I mean, the medical professions around the world try to find solutions that you won't live legally till 85, you know? So euthanasia may come into fashion, especially as nobody has money. Anyway, so... Okay, seriously. Look, when times are good and the government promises you pensions and health care, and taking care of your kids' schooling, and their university, everything, why would you save? I mean, the government promises to save for you, so it's no big surprise that the saving rate has declined in has declined in many of these countries. Now people are rapidly waking up that these promises will not be kept. So look what's happening actually in the U.S. That goes back to the first part. Very quickly after this financial crisis, as you know, the saving rates in the U.S. was zero officially. Now, that's another story whether that statistics is accurate or what it means, because actually people believed that house prices will go up forever, so they sold their second house and third house and even the house that they live in. This will be their savings for retirement. Well, bad idea. But now that they were shocked into reality, actually the saving rate in the U.S. jumped to something like from 0 to 8% last year. Now, 8% is a lot. That's about $1 trillion of domestic savings in the U.S., which, going back to Morty's first question, where the stock market is heading, if people will continue to save 8%, obviously they will consume less. And now it may help the U.S. to depend less on foreign accounts, because let's say it needs, just the government, it's about what it has, about $2 trillion in deficit. So now suddenly $1 trillion is given by domestic savings. From outside, it can now take one more trillion, that just for the government. So in that sense, you know, the United States is stabilizing, and stabilizing fast. That doesn't mean that people will be able to retire at 55, because they lost a lot of wealth, and I think with good reason they are now skeptical of whatever promises the government gave them. Well, look here in this province. Yes, we are promised, you know, we were promised health care, and we kind of get it, you know, if you wait a year for an operation, if you are still alive. So they also promised, yes, for schooling. Well, the universities try to increase their fees. So a lot of this, I don't know, we have those advertisements, you see, everybody has to do his due diligence. And I think, okay, here I finish on this note. I would say part of the reason I believe that what happened in the U.S. happened, that somehow people neglected a lot of things and they did things superficially, is because the 80s and 90s were a very unusual long period of good times. You almost had an uninterrupted, there was a small blip in 91, but otherwise things were going wonderfully in the U.S. And when things go wonderfully, then people don't think too much. It's adversity, I would say. It's, there is the saying, necessity is the mother of invention. I would say adversity is the motor of thinking. Otherwise, you just accept things. Why would you think, if everything is going so easily and well, why bother? Was this the reason that people also so easily believed that, yeah, you can retire at 55? Maybe. One thing that, unfortunately, this financial shock came together with something that in the past, when you had, let's say, the savings and loans, which lost about $1 trillion or previous big problems, could be solved because first, there was the engine within the United States. The population was relatively young, and you could still solve the problem. Not only young, but the U.S. was more open to the immigration of young and skilled people. In other countries, too, you take Japan earlier, or Europe, yes, population was relatively young. Now this financial crisis arrives when you have a country like Japan, where simply the birth rate collapsed. I mean, in about 20, 30 years, if it goes on like that, they will have 25% less population. The same thing in Italy and Spain, maybe not to the same degree. So if you think about it, who can pay for this generation's retirement? It is just not there. So yes, this advertisement may have seemed accurate, but it needed some serious due diligence. Okay, on this optimistic note, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Sorry you didn't have the chance to ask questions, but those who were entrepreneurial got their answer.
Thank you very much for answering my question.
Oh, I did. Okay.
I'd like to thank you all for coming today, and please join us for some refreshments. And we hope to see you back on the 28th of October for the talk by Stephen Grover, and he'll talk about how to keep our hearts healthy and live healthily, even in poverty.
Oh, that's easy. We will walk more.
Thank you very much.